Good morning. It's 9 after 6 on Friday, April 18th, 2008. Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey is ranked among the all-time greatest films of any genre and has to be thought of in the top 10 all-time science fiction films. This month marks the 40th anniversary of its general release, so I thought it might be a good idea to talk about it. The people who produced this show had the good grace to say yes to my request, and so here we are. We're going to spend the rest of this hour talking about this Kubrick film and taking your comments and questions as well. Joining me this morning is John Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and a frequent guest on this program when we discuss pop culture issues. Good morning, John, and thanks for being on the program today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, John. This sounds great.
Before we start, I want to play a piece, and this comes from a Channel 4 BBC documentary about 2001 A Space Odyssey. I want to play a cut. This is film director James Cameron talking about Kubrick's work.
In 1964, after the success of his dark nuclear comedy, Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick began a major motion picture. It was to be a film about abstract scientific ideas, the origin and the future of the human species, life in the cosmos, the evolution of our machines into artificial intelligence. Even to this day, Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey remains the all-time great science fiction film. Its groundbreaking photographic techniques still influence modern special effects. But as our films get ever more spectacular, 2001 reminds us that it's the ideas behind the spectacle that are still the most important special effect of all.
James Cameron talking about 2001 A Space Odyssey. John, how old were you when you first saw this movie?
Let's see. I think I was in high school, so it was probably around 17, something like that.
And I suspect that that wasn't in a theater.
No. The movie came out when I was. So if it came out this time of year, I would have been less than 6 months old. So no,
okay.
I did not see it. Can't say I saw it.
Well, not to give away too much. I was 15 when I saw it in the theater for the first time, and I'll admit that I think I paid to see it three more times.
Oh wow.
There were a group of us, we were all probably geeks, that this film profoundly affected. I actually know some people who saw it like 40 or 50 times, and they paid to get in. I wasn't that bad, but I did pay to see it more than once. But what was your reaction when you first saw it?
Well, I was really excited about it because it was a movie that my parents, or certainly my dad, had seen it when it came out, and he went out and immediately got the soundtrack. So I remember listening to the soundtrack LP from the time, I mean, as far back as I can remember. That's been in my parents' record collection, and so I listened. And he had he also had the novelization of it that Arthur C. Clarke had written. So I read the book before I saw the film. So it was kind of in the background. My dad's a scientist. He's kind of sometimes a science fiction fan, sometimes not. But this one he liked a lot. He thought it was really provocative. So it was a movie I'd heard about, and then when VCRs came out and we got one, it was one of the movies that I felt like, oh, I really have to see this. So I was all set for it. And as with most people who see the film the first time, the questions I kind of had afterwards were, what did I just see? what was this about? From what I can remember, those were my main reactions to it.
Well, I have to say, I mean, they at the time, I mean, this when it was released, 1968. We hadn't seen Star Wars yet. We hadn't seen most of the science fiction movies had special effects that were we didn't think they were cheesy at the time. But when we look at them now, when I go back and watch a movie like Fantastic Voyage. Which was a great movie at the time. You look at it and you say, holy smokes, this is really crude. But 2001 was the first movie that science fiction movie I had seen that looked like it was fairly realistic in terms of its portrayal of outer space and what would happen and and what kinds of structures there would be and so forth. It was just amazing. And for me, it was the first Stanley Kubrick film that I remembered seeing. I didn't see Spartacus in the theater, I don't think. I hadn't seen Kubrick's other work up to that time. And Later, I saw Dr. Strangelove and some of his other films, and so I had an idea of what he was like, but I had no idea who Stanley Kubrick was, but this film just captivated the people of my generation. It was just so spectacular. Let me give the phone numbers for people who might want to join in with their thoughts about this movie. And it's 40 years after it was released. Do you remember seeing it? Where were you? How old were you when you saw it? What did you think about it when you first saw this movie? Or maybe you saw it and hated it. This was a movie that was hard to be neutral about. Critics certainly weren't. And we'll talk about that. And I actually have a cut from Arthur C. Clarke talking about what he thought of the film in terms of its myth. We'll play that when we come back from the break. Lots more to come here. We're talking about the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, 40 years after its general release in April of 1968. Here are your numbers to call to be a part of the discussion. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. In Madison, please call us at 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also send an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine, today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 17 minutes after 6 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this morning. She'll be back on Monday, by the way. Her vacation will be over, and she'll be back behind the microphone, all rested and ready to go. We're talking this morning on this hour about a film that came out 40 years ago, 2001, A Space Odyssey, directed by Stanley Kubrick. He and Arthur C. Clarke wrote the screenplay, and I have a cut here that I want to play before we go back into the program. This is Arthur C. Clarke talking about the myth that rose up around this film.
Stanley wanted to create a myth, and I think he succeeded. A myth should contain all sorts of levels, and different people should have different interpretations, and that, of course, is exactly what's happened. I mean, there's a whole literature about the meaning of 2001.
Arthur C. Clarke talking about Kubrick's intent with a film. And I'm talking this morning with John Pollack, who's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and a frequent guest on the program when we discuss pop culture issues. Well, John, what about the myth around 2001, A Space Odyssey? I mean, it's become really a part of the culture, and everybody recognizes the theme music from it, certainly some of the more memorable scenes are indelibly etched in the minds of of our culture.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's got this kind of. As you were saying in the introduction, the you know, trying to explain the film, the themes are just so huge. You know, that it's about the creation of of being human, really. Of the monolith represents this transition, this abrupt transition from being apes to being more human. And that, of course, the monolith is carried on through the film, and it's about this, you know, sort of a combination of progress of people at the cutting edge of space technology heading out toward Jupiter, but it's this progress in search of this, you know, this monolith, these sort of alien beings that have been around since the incomprehensibly distant past. So just because it's so huge, I mean, that sort of sticks with you. And it's interesting because, you know, one of the things I was thinking of in your introduction when you were talking about the special effects relative to earlier films, I've shown clips of it to, like, my students, and they're always amazed at how slow it is. And even when I saw it, because I watched it on video, I saw it after I'd seen Star Wars and the first three Star Wars films. And I was amazed just at how much footage there. I mean, if you go back and watch, there's an incredible amount of footage where there's no dialogue, and it's just footage of the space station docking, or it's just footage of space, or it's footage, you know, you see like these establishing shots of the spaceship kind of floating through space, and somehow, I don't know, it's like the pace of it, the slow pace of it kind of hammers home that big epic message. You know, you describe it in the way that you have and that I have, and you wonder how would you actually sit down and make a movie of this concept, but somehow by just showing the ship drifting, it kind of reinforces the message.
Well, the other thing that Kubrick did with space, whenever the shot was of something happening in outer space, there was no noise. I mean,
yeah.
It was absolutely dead silence. And I haven't seen a science fiction film that did that. I mean, you know, you look at the Star Wars and Star Trek and the big blockbuster science fiction films, and space is a really noisy place. I mean, you can hear, you know, the various weapons firing, and when a ship moves off, it makes a sound. Well, hey, in the vacuum, there's no sound. And he was really trying to depict this in a realistic way. And you're right, the pace of this film is incredibly slow. And that's actually one of the things that some of the critics pointed out about it. There were some critics who really attacked this film. I mean, when I was reading, I went back and read a lot of the reviews. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to me to see how split some of the reviewers were. I mean, there wasn't anybody in the middle saying, oh, it's a pretty good film. It was either, oh, my God, this is the greatest film ever, or, you know, what is this piece of crap? I mean, you know, it's slow, it's boring, blah, blah, blah. And there were some shots that I thought were really, really long. And when I watch it now, mm-hmm. having seen Star Wars and all these other films that are edited at a frenetic pace,
it really
notice it, and it is it's a long film. It has an intermission in it. You know, who does a film now with an intermission? I remember seeing it in the theater. We went out and bought more popcorn. It was great.
Wow.
We have a caller who wants to join us. Let's take a call from Warren in Madison. Warren, good morning.
Good morning. I'm assuming you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you. You might make sure your radio is turned off.
I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I'm 6 years old. And one thing that sticks out in this movie to me is the first scene where a great ape takes this—I don't know if it was a bone or a stick—and smashes it. And this movie is actually a very violent movie, but it's very subtle. You got Hal trying to trash these aliens, halves in artificial intelligence. And you got this great ape. I was telling your interviewer, it was like, it was the first act of violence. This is a tool, but the tool wasn't meant to grow potatoes. The tool was like, oh my God, look, if I have something in my hand and in my strong arms and I smash it down, and it evolved like, well, maybe I could put a stone on that tool. I could put a spike on it. I guess it's a very kind of a, how should I put it? It's a very subtly kind of a nervous type of movie where we could be heading right now. But anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thanks for the call, Warren.
Yeah, that's a great idea. When I was looking back at some of the some of the writings I'd seen on it, some of the critics I'd read about the film in the past. That was one of the things that came up, is that it's a tool that one of the things that is like a turning point in civilization as portrayed by the film is that the apes become meat eaters at that point. And that as they go from, as the caller said, from growing potatoes to using tools for war and so forth, that begins there. And also the fact, the way that Cooper kind of establishes in the film, and I think it sounds kind of like a cheesy cut, but I think it works really well, is where the ape with the bone throws the bone in the air, and the film just transitions into the spaceship that's flying. That's a really cool point, and it kind of echoes what the caller was talking about, that the tools are different, but the quest remains kind of the same.
Well, it is in essence, the film is about the evolution of the human race from when that first whatever ape you want to call it discovered that something could be used as a tool, and I don't think they were probably growing anything before then. But the key scene in that sequence where this group has been driven away from a waterhole before by another group of apes, but now they've all got weapons, and there's a killing, and they take over, and it's like, okay, this clan is going to survive. They're going to thrive and do better because now they have tools and they have weapons and they can have territory and resources and so forth. Yeah, and it is. It's a, that's that great transition there between the bone flying through the air and turning and turning and turning, and then the cut to the space station. That was pretty interesting. Let me give the phone numbers again: 800-642-1234, 263-1890. We're talking about the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, this morning, and my guest is John Pollock, a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College, and a frequent guest on this program when we discuss pop culture issues. 2001 was nominated for a number of Academy Awards, and I forget how many, and it actually won an award, I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, John, I think it won for Best Visual Effects. I'm pretty sure that was it.
Yeah, that's the one. And I think, and if I'm not mistaken, was that like a special Oscar created that year, or was that because I don't think there would have been. I mean, I think one of the reasons the film was so influential is that it got filmgoers thinking about the special effects. I mean, as you had said before, you know, science fiction prior to 2001, the visual effects were almost deliberately cheesy. That it was almost a way of kind of like distancing the viewers from what was going on. That it was like a reminder you're watching this, you know, this movie. Science fiction films are often made on really low budgets, so you couldn't do anything very elaborate. But that this one, I mean, there weren't. I mean, it was to the best of my memory, it was really like Star Wars in '77. That was the next film that had the special effects as this big a part of the story. You know, for all the revolutions that went on in American filmmaking in the late '60s and early '70s. A lot of that revolution was making movies almost more TV-like, that you have, you know, these individual characters who are especially memorable and these, you know, sort of conflicted moral situations and things like that. But you don't have, like, another, you know, it's 2001 was so much of a pioneer that it's not until Star Wars that you get another, or maybe Close Encounters in 76, you get another film where the special effects are so important, and even then, after 2001, it's a few years before you get to the present where every summer, oh, what's the special effects movie? So, so it did. That was the only Oscar it won. It was nominated for a few others. Kubrick was nominated for director. The screenplay was nominated for an original screenplay. It was nominated for best set decoration. But otherwise, that's it. All it won was this Oscar for special visual effects.
Let's take a call before the news from Greg in Webster. And Greg, we'll get your comment now. You got about 30 seconds, and then we'll respond after the news. Go ahead.
I was a junior in high school when I saw that film, and I grew up in Duluth, but it wasn't playing there, so I had to go down to the Twin Cities and see it on one of these really wide screens, which would be like an Omnimax now, and I was a science fiction reader, and still am, and remember that movie, the monolith part, was based upon a Arthur C. Clarke short story called The Sentinel.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that when we come back. That's a great point, Paul. Thanks a lot for that and the call. We'll be back right after this news. I'm John Munson on the Ideas Network. It's 6:35. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine today. This hour, we're talking about Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey, 40 years after its initial release into theaters. And just before the break, we had a couple of good comments about the film, and we'll get to those in just a moment. My guest this hour is John Pollock, a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and a frequent guest on this program when we discuss pop culture issues. Our caller just before the news, John, talked about the science fiction story that the monolith portion of this film was based upon, and I actually have a cut of Keir DeLay, who played the lead in the film, talking about where this came from, and I think we'll play that now, and then we'll move on.
When I was sent the script before I started filming, I read it and thought to myself, something is vaguely familiar here. And then it hit me. I'd been a science fiction fan quite early in my life. I think I discovered science fiction when I was 12 or 13. And I was a voracious consumer of science fiction magazines. My mother would give me the annual best science fiction collection of short stories. Each year there would be one for 1951, 1952. And in one of those collections, I read a short story where the kernel of this film was in the short story. It was called The Sentinel. And it was by Arthur C. Clarke, published, I believe, originally in a British science fiction magazine in the late 1940s. I was reading it now about 1951 or 52.
That was Keir DeLay talking about the short story on which the film, at least part of it, was based. It was interesting. I read where Arthur C. Clarke actually sold 6 or 7 of his short stories to Kubrick. As possibly being used in the film. Kubrick rejected all of them, and so Clarke bought them back. That was kind of interesting. The other thing the caller brought up, and I wanted you to comment on this, the film was in some areas where they had theaters that could handle it. It was presented in something called Cinerama. What was that?
Oh, Cinerama was one of the callers talked about watching it on an IMAX-like screen, and that's what Cinerama was. It was it was like a kind of super widescreen format. I forget which. There were different film companies that had different formats like this. There was Cinerama. There was
Panavision or something like that, or something.
Panavision was another one. There was also some films were released in a 70-millimeter version instead of a 35-millimeter, so you had a wider film stock, which gave you the possibility for a sharper image. Especially if broadcast, projected on a really massive screen. So, yeah, that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, and I never got to see it in that format, and I really wish that I could have, because it must have been truly spectacular.
Yeah, well, Cinerama was used for some of the John Ford westerns, like shot in Monument Valley, were released in Cinerama.
So How the West Was Won, I think, was one of them.
Yeah. So you get that really big, so you're in Monument Valley, and it's just everything's massive, and get an idea of how big the space is. And again, I mean, that would have been, Kubrick would have really pushed for that, because that was, that's one of the things that really sticks with you, is the idea of, space being so infinite, and these, humans, these tiny little spaceships are traveling through. That would have been the way to see it.
There was actually a Cold War aspect to this film, wasn't there?
A tiny one, yeah. There's a scene toward the beginning of the film when the U.S. astronauts go out to the space station. And in the film, by 2001, the U.S. and the Soviets are sort of, well, first of all, there are still Soviets, but they're sort of collaborating. They kind of it seems like it's kind of expected that they're in touch with each other about what they're finding out in space. And the American astronauts deliberately cover up the monolith. They say that there's an epidemic, and so they tell the Soviets they can't go back in there. But there's really, they found this monolith buried on the moon, and it's kind of getting the plot started. So yeah, so it's like, it's interesting. It's sort of, the fact that the Cold War comes up, it's maybe kind of a nod to Dr. Strangelove, which Kubrick had made just 4 years before, where in Dr. Strangelove, of course, the world goes to a global thermonuclear war, and the Cold War is cooled down quite a bit by then. I mean, it's just there's this kind of cordiality and just being a little evasive. Replacing the bombastic stereotypes in Strangelove. But yeah, there's just a tiny little bit of it, and then really the bulk of the rest of the film. And I think it's also, like, within the history of science fiction, a lot of science fiction reads really well as a Cold War metaphor. That alien invaders and so forth, and occasionally there even are communists in cahoots with various nefarious groups. The Cold War is often kind of part and parcel of science fiction films. Kubrick brings it up early on. You kind of, it's what Alfred Hitchcock called a MacGuffin. You think it's going to be part of the plot. You think there's going to be this U.S.-Russian space race, something like that. And there's a brief little scene, and that's pretty much, you forget all about it. And the film goes to the more introspective and far-reaching questions about the definitions of humanness and so forth. And the Cold War is totally left in the dust.
Another kind of a first, something we take for granted now but wasn't quite as common at that time, was product placement.
Yeah, I mean, I remember even when I saw it, I mean, as I said, I saw it sometime in the 80s and on video, that I was struck by the fact there were product placements in there, that Hilton in 2001 has gotten the Space Station Hotel. There's also, I was in one of the reviews I was reading, a critic mentions that I guess Pan Am, I think, has a role in the ships heading out to the space station. Bell Telephone is in there. So there's like a Howard Johnson's restaurant in the spaceship, like there was. Howard Johnson's was a hotel chain, and the restaurants were also the kind of things you'd find on the Turnpike. It's a nice touch because, and I remember, you know, seeing it and kind of laughing about it. And when I was in college, I got to see it in the theater, and it was the same thing. The whole crowd kind of chuckled. It sort of breaks up the, you know, the awesomeness of the film that you've, you know, you're still kind of reeling from this transition from apes to people in space in the future. And you have these, you know, awe-inspiring shots of the ship docking in the space station, and then you see the Hilton logo. You know, it's sort of jarring, and it's kind of this, you know, moment of light relief in what otherwise is a film that asks all these great big questions.
Well, let me give you the reaction of somebody who's a little older, having first seen that, and there hadn't really been product placement in films at that time. Mm-hmm. What I remember of my response to that was that it made it look more realistic.
Sure.
Like, this is really going to happen.
Yeah.
And we had Bell Telephone then. Okay, so there's Bell Telephone in space. And we had, there was Howard Johnson's. Fine, this is familiar. So it projected this idea that even in the future, the culture we have now, is some parts of it are going to survive. That's how I took it. Let's try and get a call in here before we have to go to weather. I want to take a call next from Paul in Hickson. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having the show. I was about 10 years old when I went to this film with my father, and I just remember just being in awe through the whole thing. And afterwards, we just came out of that theater saying, wow, you know, what did we just see? And it gave us so much to talk about. I also found that he went out and bought the soundtrack for the movie also and the book, which we kind of passed around in our family and read, and it gave us a lot to discuss. We found it very interesting. I have also found that this film is very polarizing, that people either seem to love it or hate it. And back in the 70s, when I went to UW-Madison, it was shown in the student theaters quite a bit. And I remember taking a girl to a date there, not the best date movie, but a lot of comments. Seems like a kind of a more polarizing film than most. And once again, I'm finding this very interesting, and thank you for the show.
Hey, thanks for the call. Polarizing aspect, boy, I'll tell you what, I had my wife and I watched this together, and she picked up a magazine about a third of the way through and started reading. She just didn't like it at all. And, you know, so.
That's kind of what I was thinking, is that certainly when I was in college, this would have been like almost the ideal date movie, just because you know who you're dealing with right away, you know. You know if you're going to want to go out on another date or not based on, you know, can your date, you know, talk about this film.
It was hip to pretend that you understood what Kubrick was trying to do at that time. On one viewing, it was pretty hard to figure out all of it. And even some critics said they had to see it more than once to appreciate it. We're at weather time, and we'll come back. We've got more callers. We'll get to them, and we have some more clips to play that might illustrate some of the points that have been being made here. We're talking about the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, and my guest is John Pollock, who is a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and a frequent guest on this program when we discuss pop culture issues. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 6:47, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, we're going to talk about the life of Melvin Laird, who had a long political career. He was a state senator in Wisconsin. He became a U.S. congressman and eventually went on to be the Secretary of Defense under the first Nixon administration. And there's a new biography out about Mel Laird, and we're going to talk about his life with the author of that biography, Dale Van Atta. That's coming up after the news at 7 o'clock. This hour, it's 2001, A Space Odyssey, and we're talking about that film 40 years after its initial release into theaters with John Pollock, who is a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and a frequent guest when we discuss pop culture issues. And we'll take a phone call next from Saul in Stevens Point. Saul, good morning.
I really enjoy this discussion. I was a big fan, and I was in the university at the time. Of course, all the intellectuals get together to talk about what they'd seen instead of just watching the movie. And it was pretty obvious to me because I was, you know, a nerd science fiction nut when I was a kid. And it was evolution, you know, you went through, every time you saw the monolith, you saw a new stage of evolution. And then the last one is when they see it in space after he's ejected from the station and stuff. He becomes a child of the universe or a child of the stars, this kind of really sappy thing with he turns into a fetus, you know. So he's reborn again. And so, I mean, I kind of liked it in a science fiction-y way, but I did think it was a little corny, and I love the movie. But I also have to say that your guest missed out on Forbidden Planet, which was terrific when it came out, and it's still... It does very well because it's got a great story, and the special effects really are special, except for the painted backdrops in a few scenes. And then you had The Day the Earth Stood Still, fantastic movie, and War of the Worlds. You know, the special effects really were special, and they still hold up very well.
Yeah, I stand corrected.
Yeah, well, I stand corrected. The caller made a good point there that, there were a few of those right at the films he's talking about are from the early 50s, so it's really the kind of the beginnings of a lot of modern science fiction. And, there was a point in time there where the major studios really kind of backed science fiction and put the money into it where they could build more elaborate and kind of realistic special effects, pay for kind of the top line screenwriters and directors to make the films. And then it was kind of a change from science fiction in the 1930s, where it was often relegated to serials and B-movies that were like the second features, as well as the majority of science fiction in the later 50s. That also was kind of a return to the B-movie format that they were, kind of quickly turned out with low budget and so forth. But no, he's right. I mean, the ones he's talked about are definitely classics of the genre, and I think in a lot of those films, what I think kind of stands out is, and where I'd still say they're a little different from Space Odyssey, is that the gadgetry and the special effects are not quite as important, that those really do kind of focus on the story, they focus on the character development and so forth. And one of the things about science fiction that, you know, for a lot of people found kind of fun about it, but is, you know, a characteristic of it, is that the focus is often on the gadgets. And going back again into, like, you know, Flash Gordon stuff in the 30s, it's the ray guns, it's the spaceships, it's things like that, and the relationships don't really get developed. Where 2001 plays with that is then you have, you know, to that point and arguably to the present, the most awesome gadgetry ever and beautifully portrayed, and where the characters are deliberately, I think, kind of wooden. I mean, where in science fiction... Oftentimes, you go to a science fiction film, the acting is just really bad. They don't have very talented actors in there, and the actors are sort of slumming their way through. In 2001, you know, the actors are just so expressionless. I mean, Kubrick deliberately chooses Gary Lockwood and Keira DeLay, who look almost identical, and they're in these spacesuits. You can, you know, hardly tell, you know, who's Dave, who's Frank. And it's almost like kind of making fun of the whole science fiction convention.
Well, and there isn't a whole lot of dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, there are long shots where you see people just kind of existing in an environment, and it can be very hard to watch if you're not prepared for that. Kubrick comes out of a background. His background was as a photographer, there's some interesting things about this film. For example, all the scenes that were shot in Africa, they weren't shot in Africa. There were still pictures shot in Africa, and they used a unique front projection system that worked pretty well at the time. But Kubrick would not fly. He didn't fly in airplanes, and so he didn't go to Africa. He had the film crew down there shooting stills, and they brought those back, and that became the backdrop for that section of the movie. We have an email from Ingrid. Says she enjoys the program, and says, I was so drawn to Hal. In fact, I think about Hal off and on. His personality was so conflicted. and I'd like to hear your guest illuminate Hal. Well, Hal was became the villain of the piece, but Hal was a pretty cool part of the film for most of us who saw it at that time.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have written about Hal that, I mean, it seems like Hal's sort of a warning about the what we now call artificial intelligence, that, you know, a persistent fear in both in science fiction and among people who study, you know, actual technology, a fear that as people program machines to be smarter, that they take on more human characteristics. And in this film, Chris, we've kind of debated about, you know, why does Hal do what he does? That some people have said that, well, he's a machine, and machines can only do what they're programmed to do, and he's given this kind of conflicted assignment, that there's an ostensible purpose and there's a real purpose, and he can't square the two of them. He can't put those two together, and so it sort of short-circuits him. And that's why he, you know, freezes out the one astronaut and seems to, you know, and well, it goes after the other.
We couldn't do this show without playing this clip.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
So they gave Hal a personality and he turned on him.
Yeah.
Let's take a call from Steve in Rice Lake. Steve, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, great topic. Hey, I'm the same age as your guest there. I'm 40 and never saw the film originally. Clued in on it after Star Wars by my father. But like all great films, it has three terrific things about it. It has a great story. It has super cinematography, which I include in costuming and special effects. But the biggest part about that movie and all the movies of that genre and all your major films is your soundtrack. You take anything from, like, Planet of the Apes to Future World to Jaws to The Godfather to Lawrence of Arabia and, of course, 2001. If you didn't have the soundtrack, you wouldn't have a movie, and I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks.
Well, that's a great point, Steve, and I'm going to put some Blue Danube in the background for this part of the discussion because the soundtrack really was a major feature of this film.
Yeah. Yeah, it really. I mean, it's one of those films where Kubrick. It's not the original music that stands out so much, but these various classical or sort of modern classical pieces. And now you can't hear them without thinking of 2001. I mean, Blue Danube's a great example. Thus Spake Zarathustra, and so forth. But yeah, if you go to a symphony performance or the chamber orchestra or something, and they have this on the on the program that night, then you just automatically think of, you know, scenes in 2001.
Let's go to Paul in Clintonville next. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. First, to the man who saw this in Cinerama, I did too, and as far as I'm concerned, to anybody who did see it there in that particular format, that was the only way to see this picture. I really enjoyed it that way. A couple things, and I know we're running out of time. If you recall, it was a little over a year later that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And I think
yes,
this really had, you know, quite an impact on our generation at the time. It's kind of like the world stopped on that day. And I think, the groundwork was almost laid by Mr. Kubrick in that movie. that was quite the feeling. The other thing was, it was a couple years later that I think the movie was called 2014. It came out, and that was with Ray Scheider, John Lithgow, Helen Mirren, and it picked up where this movie left off, to the evolution of man. And it was quite the piece, too. It's still out there. I wonder if your commentator has seen that one.
Yeah, got about 30 seconds, John.
Yeah, the film was actually 2010, and it came out in 1984. And yeah, actually, I did see that one in the theater. I remember it being an okay science fiction movie. It's sort of a task of tying up the loose ends of the first one, which is pretty substantial. But yeah, it was okay, but nothing like 2001.
Well, we got callers lined up. We could probably do another hour on this, but my self-indulgent hour is now over. Thanks, John, for being with me on this.
All right. Well, thanks for inviting me. It was a blast.
John Pollock is a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and a frequent guest on this program when we discuss pop culture issues. Karen Prager, thank you for producing this. She also did on-air production. And if you'd like to hear it again, you can go to the radio store and ask them if you can buy a copy, 800-747-7444, or go online and you can listen to it as a stream. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network.